You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
It's a pleasure to welcome our old friend and colleague Olivier Roy at OSI. He's been here a number of times before. In fact, we've been crossing paths for probably, 12, 13 years. Olivier was last here, I think it was during the banlieue riots or right after them. He's in the U.S. In part to talk about his new book, which was published over the summer, which is called Secularism Confronts Islam. It's a willful mistranslation of laïcité, which in fact the translation and adoption of the concept of laïcité is the subject of the book and about which Olivier will speak. It's timely in a grotesque way. I was prompted by was reading the book last night. I looked up Islamofascism, which I guess there was a whole right wing action dedicated to that Islamofascism Week, which has a dreadful website of its own. There's another OSI context to which I should refer, which is that in the time since Olivier last spoke here, our EU MAP program, which is the European Union Monitoring and Advocacy Program, has begun a European city study looking at 11 cities, major cities in Europe, and dealing with questions of identity and integration of Muslim populations, and Olivier is a senior advisor of that project, and will actually be having Nazia Hussein, who directs the project, here in New York early next month to talk about it. Before we invite Olivier to speak, I'm supposed to remind him that he's supposed to speak loudly and clearly into the microphone. I'm supposed to remind the audience to use the microphone when posing questions. This is not because it's such a big room, but because the event may be recorded for dissemination on our website subsequently. I'm supposed to point out the nearest emergency exit, which I don't really know. I think it's out there the way you came in. And I'm supposed to advise you all that the event will be recorded and may be made available on the website. So bear that in mind. Without further ado, Olivier. And is this on? Yeah. Yes.
thank you, Anthony. So as you know, the Muslim population in Europe is based on a massive labor migration. Both factors are, of course, intertwined. The fact that most of the Muslims who are presently living in Western Europe come are labor migrants or the children of labor migrants. And the fact that the bulk of the labor migrants in Europe are Muslims. So it's very important. If we want to make a comparison, for example, with the USA, the comparison would be possible if the Mexicans were Muslim, but they're not. So the social dimension and the religious dimension are, of course, connected. Even if, as I will explain, if we look at the second and third generation, the connection is weakening because of the growth of middle class with a Muslim background. But at the beginning, there was almost no middle class. And this dearth of Muslim middle class had a big impact, of course, on the representation of the Muslim population in Europe, both politically, socially, economically. There is a constant interplay between the perception of the Muslims as a faith community and as an ethnic group or as an underclass. And these three levels are always confused, you know. The confusion is very clear, for example, if I can speak of a clear confusion, but when the American journalists come to Europe, you know, they speak of Muslim suburbs or of Muslim riots, you know, referring to the youth riots of in France 2 years ago, of Muslim ghetto. If we look at France, for instance, there are destitute neighborhoods, but these destitute neighborhoods are not Muslim ghettos. The population is mixed. All the labor migrants are not Muslim. And the labor migrants, or the migrants, let's say, who are coming now are less Muslims than 20 or 30 years ago. Now, the bulk of the immigration is coming from Africa and China, for instance. So there are less and less. So the Muslim factor is less important now in the present migration than it used to be 30 years ago. The European countries had managed, you know, the issue of this labor migration by using two totally opposed paradigms. One is the paradigm of multiculturalism, and the other is the paradigm of assimilation. France has had and still has an assimilationist policy. The official term is integration, not assimilation. By the way, everybody is speaking about integration, you know, the British, the Dutch, the French. But the definition of integration is not the same. Northern Europe and Germany used the concept, the paradigm of multiculturalism to integrate the Muslims. France used the concept of assimilation. In Spain, Italy, Greece, there was no debate because there was no Muslim migrants in the 70s and 80s. Muslim migration has touched Spain and Italy very recently. So in Spain, for instance, the number of Muslims has grown from something like 50,000 to 1 million in a period of less than 10 years. And in Italy now, they also have a huge Muslim immigration. But if we compare Italy, it's not the same sort of migration than 30 years ago, as I said. The migration now in Italy, you have a lot of Chinese, for example, of Romanians also. So the Muslim factor is one of the factors among others. And in Greece, they had a paradigm, the paradigm of an ethnic minority. By law, the Muslims in Greece are considered as an official ethnic minority, a Turkish ethnic minority. Greece is one of the few countries in Europe which has, you know, a law recognizing ethnic minority with a special legal status. It's the Ottoman law. The civil courts for Greek Muslims are using the Ottoman code. Still written, by the way, in Osmanli. But this paradigm doesn't work with the new immigration, which is not Turkish at all. You know, so when you have Arabs, you cannot be difficult, you know, to have them to refer to the Ottoman code, you know, if they want to marry or things like that. You know. So Greece has confronted with also the same problem and is still using the paradigm of multiculturalism. And during 20 years, there was no communications between the two paradigms, if I can say that. In the 80s and 90s, I was never invited, for example, in Great Britain or in Germany to speak about Islam and immigration. Never. I was invited to speak about Afghanistan, about Iran, about Middle East, but never about Muslims in Europe. Because the two paradigms were so distant that, in fact, we had nothing to say to each other. And France came under attack regularly and still coming under attack by the State Department for impinging on religious freedom. About the veil affair, in the scarf affair in France. And the British were as much adamant against the French policy towards Muslims in the 80s and 90s. So the Dutch too, the Germans too, and so. But suddenly, for different reasons, beginning from 2001, there was a big crisis. So 9/11, of course, but in Holland, it's the assassination of Theo van Gogh, and the terrorist attacks in Madrid and London. So suddenly, there is a big debate in the so-called multiculturalist countries about the validity of the multiculturalist model. If you go to Holland, to the Netherlands now, there's a consensus, right or wrong, that multiculturalism has failed. It doesn't work. Right. But what to do? What to do? In Great Britain, they still stick to the multiculturalist model, but there is, as you may know, also an increase of critics towards the multiculturalist model. But in France, there is also a crisis of the assimilationist model. The crisis appeared first in 1989 with the first scarf affair. And it was a tremendous psychodrama, even if only some young schoolgirls were involved. At most, there have been 100 in France schoolgirls coming to school with a veil. 100. For a population of school children of millions. But it was a big story, which ended with a law in 2004 banning the scarf and any ostensible religious sign from schools. And 10 young Sikhs have been expelled because they were wearing a turban. Nobody noticed before, but suddenly, because of a law, they had to be expelled. Because, of course, they didn't want to give up their turban. And now there is a special school for six, with only 20 school children. And why was it a crisis? It's because the girls coming to school were perfectly integrated. So it was not a story of primo immigrants coming from a remote Turkish village and bringing to France their traditional customs and dress and things like that. Absolutely not. These girls were born in France, educated, the best pupils at school, no pressure from the parents, the mothers were not wearing the veil, and they suddenly decided on their own to wear the veil. The second scarf story was in 2003, and it was a story which has triggered, the process to have a law. The two girls who came to school, their name, two sisters, their name was Levi. So, a bit difficult, to speak about pressure from the family, in this case, the father is a secular, is a communist lawyer, by the way. He was as surprised as anybody, to see that suddenly that his two daughters decided to convert to Islam and to wear a veil. It was a big scandal, because as usually as do the converts, they are far more tough on their attitude than the bulk of the population. So there is a sense also that the assimilationist paradigm is not working. So there is a big debate now in Europe. What to do? Why didn't it work? But many people now are embracing the concept of clash or dialogue of civilizations. Now, So the European Union, the UN, they have launched a big program called Alliance of Civilizations, you know, more than dialogue, you know, it's an increase in competition. There are dozens of conferences, meetings on this topic. But the problem is nobody, or very few people, had really tried to understand why did it fail. And in fact, for me, both paradigms failed for exactly the same reason. They both suppose that there is a strong connection between religion and culture. They both suppose that a religion is always embedded on a culture, and a culture is always based on a religion. And this, for multiculturalism, it's obvious. A religious community is understood as a cultural ethnic community. The Arabs are supposed to be Muslims. The Asians. The problem is that if you look at the Asians in Great Britain, most of them are Hindus. Not necessarily most, but you have a lot of Hindus, some Buddhists, some communists. What does it mean? If you go to the British hospitals, you'll find some booklets. Know the Asian culture. What does it mean? You know, pork or beef? What do you do? Asian culture. Know the Muslim culture. Muslim culture. What does it mean? You know, Muslim culture. Is fasting during Ramadan a religious trait or a cultural one? What about an unbelieving Muslim? There are some people in France, for example, Abdelwahab Medeb, who define himself as an atheist Muslim. So he doesn't fast, he drinks wine. How do we define a Muslim culture in this case? So, and secondly, this idea that religious and cultures are intertwined has a consequence. What about the Western culture? Is the Western culture a Christian culture or a secular culture? And in Europe, we have the debate is about that, specifically in France. Because France has a long tradition of militant political secularism. You know? A secularism which we call laïcité. And is it didn't, in fact, my book is about laïcité in France. But the publisher thought that laïcité cannot be neither translated nor understood here. So he put secularism. But laïcité is not secularism. Great Britain is a secularized country. It's not, there is no laïcité. If we define laïcité by a strong separation of church and state, the USA are supposed to be laïc, but they are not. No, religion does play a big role in US politics. But there is a strict constitutional and legal separation between church and state. So the separation of church and state is not enough, you know, to define secularization or laïcité. So we have to make a distinction. Separation of church and state is a legal and constitutional principle. But it doesn't mean that society is secular. The society might be very religious, you know, as supposedly are the states. You can have an absolutely secular country where there is no separation between church and state. Denmark. In Denmark, there is an official church. The Lutheran church is an official church, and everybody has to register births and marriages with the local Lutheran priest. He has no right to ask you anything about your religion. He just registers. But there is no separation of church and state. But Denmark is one of the more secularized countries in Europe. The attendance for church services is 410% in Denmark. So we have to make a distinction between secularization and separation of church and state. Secularization is a cultural and social phenomenon. Separation of church and state is a constitutional principle. And laïcité is something, you know, even more complex. In legal terms, in France, laïcité is no more than separation of church and state. The law of 1905, which is a founding law, still the founding law of laïcité, never said that religious should be kept in private. It doesn't say that. The law says that there is a separation between church and state, that the state doesn't recognize any specific church, and that religious activities are free, but should be regulated if occurring in the public sphere. That's all. No. It means that a Catholic church has the right to ring bells. You are not obliged to ring bells in your room, in your home, you know. You may ring bells outside, you know, and sometimes you have to. But there are regulations concerning ringing bells. It could be prohibited. It could be prohibited during night and so and so. So it's not the expulsion of religion from the public space. But because in France, the separation of church and state has been the consequence of a political struggle between the Republican state and the Catholic Church, there is in this separation a militant and antagonistic dimension, if I can say that, which doesn't exist here. Here, in the states, the separation of church and state has been decided to protect the churches. In France, it has been decided to protect the state. So the perception of the law of this separation is totally different. And in France, we have a tradition of militant laïcité. And in this case, laïcité is not just a legal and constitutional principle. It's an ideology or a philosophy. The laicists don't call their thinking an ideology. They call it a philosophy, philosophy of laïcité. I call it an ideology. But, you know, we know what we mean by that. It means that for them, laïcité is a set of values which should be imposed in the public space by the state. And that religion should be kept private, which is not in the law. Which is not in the law. It's why, it explains why, by using the 1905 law, it was impossible to expel the veiled veiled school girls from schools. There had to be a new law, a new law, far more offensive, if I can say that, you know, far more intrusive than the former law. The idea in France that, was that once you become a French, religion doesn't matter. So the law, until now, the law had changed, but the law on citizenship was quite open. It was rather easy to get the citizenship. Schools were open, no faith schools. No, there are faith schools, but the system is based on government schools. And faith schools, by the way, most of the faith schools are under the government control and teach exactly the same things than the other government schools. The only difference is, by the way, some Orthodox Jewish schools, where the curriculum is very religious. In fact, in France, the religious schools, the truly religious schools, where you teach a religious curriculum mandatory to the children, are Jewish schools. You have almost no Catholic schools, no Protestant schools, and no Islamic schools. Interestingly enough. So the idea was that integration works through assimilation, and once you are French, you speak French, you behave French, and religion is private. So the idea is also that there is a connection between religion and culture, that there is a French culture, and in this French culture, religion is something which is private. So here also, the idea is once you leave your culture, you leave your religion, or your attitude towards your religion is totally different. So both paradigms, multiculturalism and assimilationism suppose that there is a strong connection between religion and culture. The problem is that this connection is disappearing for the second and third generation. It's an old story, you know. Fundamentalisms are never the expression of traditional cultures and societies. Fundamentalisms are always not only the expression, but a factor of deculturation. If you take Salafism, for example, in Islamic world, Salafism is a fight against Muslim cultures. The Taliban in Afghanistan were not fighting against Western influence at the beginning. They were fighting against the traditional Afghan culture. The same for the evangelicalists. They are not supporting a traditional culture. Something which is very common for all fundamentalism is to consider that the surrounding society is materialistic, secular, pornographic, and against religion. You know. Fundamentalisms are always an endeavor to save religion from culture, because the culture is seen as negative, either irrelevant or negative. Hence, the cultural war against TV, against entertainment, and things like that. You know. So deculturation has worked. I spoke about that some time ago here, so I will not go back to that. But it's clear that the guys who join Al-Qaeda in Europe have all of them a background of uprooting, deculturation, deterritorialization, you know, and political activism, of course. That is never the expression of a traditional culture. It's a youth movement. It's a generational struggle. So the problem is that by this disconnect between religion and culture, religion is taken a different shape. First, it's more assertive. It asserts itself as a pure religion. And the believers, in this case, want to establish a faith community. A community which is based on something they have in, something they have in common, and sometimes the only thing they have in common, religion. So secularizations, secularism always entails to some sort fundamentalism, because this process of deculturation of religion almost always tend to a different form of religious assertiveness in the public sphere. And that's exactly what we are witnessing in Europe. But for me, it's more good news than bad news, because it entails a disconnect between religion on one hand and society on the other hand. It means that we are achieving, through fundamentalism, the process of separation of church and state. That religion is now linked to a faith community based on a voluntary choice. The problem is that our governments, public opinion, journalists, didn't acknowledge this change. So they still use multiculturalist pattern. They still speak indifferently of migrants, Arab, Muslims. While there is now a clear disconnect. And the sign, the proof of the disconnection, is the phenomena of conversions. Because religion now is only based on a faith community, it's not inherited. It's clear now that people choose the religion. Of course, sometimes they say that they have the religion of parents. You know. But there is a big phenomenon of conversion. And in every sense, you know. Let's take, give you some example. So in Spain, Spain was Catholic at the beginning of the 90s, and there was a small Protestant minority, a very small Jewish minority, and a small Muslim minority. And now we have a big Muslim minority and a big Protestant minority. So some 400,000 Protestants in Spain. There were 20,000 20 years ago. Who are these guys? They are Equatorians, migrants from Latin America, who converted to Protestantism in Spain through the influence of preachers, Spanish-speaking preachers, trained somewhere in the Bible Belt here. 400,000. In France too. The bulk now of the Protestant community in France is made of evangelicalists. If you take the map of the mosques in France, and the mosque which has been built during the last 20 years, and if you take the map of the Protestant churches built during the last 20 years, it's the same map. For very good reasons. It's the same population. Uprooted, migrants, second generation, people like that. We have now in France an Arab evangelical church. And these people are not Christian Lebanese converted to Protestantism. They are North Africans converted to Protestantism. And there are thousands of followers. The Catholic Church, the good thing with the Catholic Church is that it's a bureaucracy. So they have records. The Catholic Church has a rate of conversion among Muslims which has increased from 200 10 years ago to 400 a year. But the Catholic Church is not preaching among Muslims. They don't send missionaries. The Protestants do, not the Catholics. So it means that people are coming. The reverse is true also. Many non-Muslims are converting to Islam. As I said last time, in Europe, almost 20% of Al-Qaeda militants are converts. Al-Qaeda is the Muslim, quote-unquote, organization which has the highest level of converts. How interesting. It's why the issues of conversions, apostasy, are now at the core of the debate in Islam. Malaysia, Afghanistan, and this will increase. So, I will end on that. You know, we instead of bringing back a concept of multiculturalism, which is no more working, we should acknowledge that Islam in Europe is a faith community, not an ethnic minority group, not based on an ethnic minority group. And that it's good news, and it should be considered as any other religious communities, and treated through the prism of freedom of religion, and not through the lens of minority groups. This goes also along with the call, the will of most of the Muslims to be citizens. Of course, some of them don't want. There is a trend, specifically in Great Britain, of separatedness. Yeah. Saying that we will never be like you, we want to be considered as a specific group with our own law, Sharia law. But here, there's a problem of who is a Muslim. It could be based only on a voluntary basis. If not, we are no more in Europe, we are no more in the West. Our political system is based on the on individual freedom. So the only way to stick with the principle of individual freedom is to acknowledge a religious group as a faith community, as a church, and not as an ethnic minority. And if we do that, we'll get rid of the endless debates about the impact of the Iraq war, of the Israelo-Palestinian conflict of Afghanistan among the European Muslims. Except for Great Britain, there is no impact of the Israelo-Palestinian conflict, the Iraq war, the war in Afghanistan, among European Muslims. They don't care. But people, the authorities, care about the fact that they could care. So we always address the Muslim and say, look, we do our best to solve the Israelo-Palestinian conflict. But the answer is, okay, that's good. Do your best and good luck. But we want mosques. We want halal food. There's a problem with the cemetery. What about the veil? Okay, these are the real issues. Yeah. What about discrimination and social problems, labor markets, and like that? That are the real issues which preoccupy the European Muslims. to be acknowledged as citizens and Muslims, not to be acknowledged as a Middle Eastern diaspora. So we have to give up the diaspora paradigm, which is at the basis of, in fact, multiculturalism as it is understood in Europe. And we have to go on these two principles, citizenship and religious freedom of religion.
Okay, thank you, Olivier. And as usual, you challenge and provoke us. In the book, you say that the difference between multiculturalism and assimilation as a strategy towards dealing with religious communities, in a sense, is a product, you say, of Anglo-Saxon indulgence, which is a bit too naive, in your words, and Gallic suspicion, which is a bit too pathological. And but you're advocating this model of secularism or laïcité, the French model, as a kind of, I don't know, somehow signaling both its effectiveness as a policy, but also as responding to a shift in mood from indulgence to suspicion. I was interested in hearing a little bit more about what evidence you see as the success of laïcité and also the adoption of laïcité de facto in Europe as a strategy for dealing with these communities. And you assert that multiculturalism is, I think you say, dead. In Europe, or it's dying, and we'll leave the United States out of it, I think, for here, for the moment. But you know, what evidence do you bring to show that multiculturalism is dead?
The impossibility to define something which could be called a Muslim culture. We know what Muslim is as a religion. We know what Islam is as a religion, but the concept of Muslim culture has no meaning. For instance, you know, the idea that Muslims have a specific culture. So our police, the special branch in France, they are tracking, you know, everything which could be a sign of problems. And they are looking at what they call the ethnic business. For example, Moroccan restaurants of couscous, Turkish restaurant, and so on and so. And the higher number of ethnic restaurants in a place for them is a proof that it's a ghetto. Yeah. But in fact, the Salafi, the Wahhabi, the people who are making problems for the police, they never opened a traditional couscous. What they opened is a halal McDonald's. You will never be served by the veiled woman in a traditional restaurant. Never. But now the fashion among the young bearded, I would say barbu, in France is to have the last one was called Muslim Mac Burger. So it's a triple play, you know, Muslim in English, because it's very fashionable, you know, to have signs in English in France. It's better than to say Musulman, Muslim. It's more fashionable. Mac, you see to what they are referring to. Beur, B-E-U-R, which is a slang, you know, for second generation Muslim. And they... the waitresses are wearing a classical McDonald's dress, but with a scarf. So this is a real change. And the guy who has a couscous in front, the Moroccan traditional Muslim with a restaurant in front of that, he says, these young guys are totally crazy. You know? I will never allow my daughter to work there. Al-Qaeda is a good proof of this deculturation. You know, it's totally deculturated. And then, on the more political terms, the inability to have community leaders. If you had an ethnic minority, it would have been possible to find leaders. All our governments are looking for community leaders. We want leaders. And of course, there are volunteers. Many people are coming, I am a leader, you know. But none of these so-called community leaders is able to deliver the goods. The British policy to counter terrorism is based, not exclusively, but largely on dealing with the community leaders. But the community leaders, they don't know anything about disenfranchised youth. They don't know. And in France, it's the government who tried to create a community in order to have leaders. You know? And the government has, not officially because the law is supposed to prevent them to do that, but the government has appointed leaders who are recognized by nobody. You know? In some places, for example, at the local level, the mayor, usually they want to have one interlocutor from the Muslim, and they say to the Muslim, okay, tell me who is your leader, and I will take him as my deputy. So a guy comes and says, I'm the leader. A second comes, no, he is not the leader, I am the leader, and so on, specifically in France. And, you know, we have so 20, 25 leaders competing each other. It's why we have very few big mosques. It's not because it's prevented. It's because nobody wants, among the Muslims, very few of them want to have a big cathedral mosque. They prefer to have their own local mosques with their friends, you know, or people with whom they share the same perception of religion. If we look at the consumption habits, if we look at the sociology, marriages, fertility rate, consumption habits, things like that, there is the disparity which existed before are now vanishing away. The comportments of the Muslims is now almost aligned on the mainstream population. And for example, in terms of birth rates, the idea that the Muslims are making more children than the other is not true, except in Spain and Italy, because people are no more making children there. So it's another story. But elsewhere, as soon as you arrive at the second and third generations, the sociological attitude of the Muslims is the same than the mainstream population.
I mean, I'm not sure whether that is exactly. I'll give the audience the time to ask questions. But the idea of laïcité being adopted as a European strategy.
No, I am advocating to adopt laïcité as a legal system, a constitutional system, not as an ideology. I think the French should give up the concept of ideological laïcité. Laïcité is not a set of values. It's a set of rules for the game. It's a set of laws and a constitutional principle of separation of church and state. It should not be seen as a philosophy or as an ideology. But it is, and this is the problem.
In the course of his remarks, I remembered that we're in part sponsoring with the Alliance Française something called Beurre is Beautiful, which is Maghreb French filmmaking, part of an Arab film festival here in New York, taking place next week. If you want to get to the Muslim mug burger in the film medium. So, some questions.
Circumstances in Europe in which distinct ethnic group in, or was seen as a distinct ethnic group in Yugoslavia. And so, given the fact that these categories sometimes seem to demonstrate this kind of fluidity, my question is anything of that sort taking place today?
There are some people among the Muslim population who are advocating such a shift. Abdel Wahab Medeb, as I said, when he calls himself an atheist Muslim, clearly. He doesn't want to give an ethnic dimension to that, to the term Muslim. He prefers to give it a cultural dimension, but clearly for him it means Arab. And we have a trend specifically among the part of this new middle class, you know, which is not very practicizing, to try to define themselves as some sort of a ethnic group, you know, Arab. For instance, they try to promote teaching of Arabic outside the mosques as a cultural language outside the mosques. And if you look to there is a good way to find where they are. Everywhere you have an association called Avicenna. These are these people, because for them, for good or bad reasons, Avicenna is a model, you know, of a cultural Arabity. They don't speak in ethnic terms, they speak in cultural terms, but in this case, yes, it's quite the same thing. There is also a movement on the left, ultra-left, to redefine in some sort of neo-ethnic terms the second and third generation of migrants, the indigens of the Republic, you know, that's the name of this organization, this movement. Trying to say that, in fact, we have imported our former colonies in France, and the relation between dominant society and the second generation is the same sort of relation that between colonizers and colonized. You know. And the everyday racism is working in this direction. You know. People who, like our Minister of Justice, Rashida Dati, she has nothing Muslim. No. She drinks wine. She doesn't seem to fast. She never speaks about religion. Nobody saw her at any religious event. But there is a permanent, you know, reference in the newspapers to the fact that she's her parents were migrants. Permanent. No. So at the end, this some sort of discrimination from outside could lead to the feeling of belonging to an ethnic group. But in this case, they don't use, except Abdel Wahab Medeb for different reasons, in this case they don't want to be called Muslims, because Muslims is associated with the mosques, with the imams. So there is a competition of leadership here. And this educated middle class is not in good terms with the, I would say, the bulk of the imams, because the imams in Europe are not very well educated, and until now it may change, but until now the level of education is rather low among the imams. So we have also this competition, and it's possible, absolutely possible, that we may see the emergence of a secular neo-ethnic movement claim some sort of a representation of this population. I don't think it will work very well, because the call for citizenship is very strong among the youth, you know, to be considered as individual, as individuals and not as members of a specific community. But the trend you are referring to does exist.
Oh, and you know, I forgot to remind people they're supposed to use the mic because it's being recorded.
Well, you're advocating for laïcité as a constitutional principle of the separation of church and state, citizenship, and freedom of religion. But how do you propose to get there? It sounds like in France this would require public debate and a complete constitutional overhaul, and that the right now the rights framework for looking at freedom of religion from the European Court of Human Rights gives tremendous respect to each state to make its own determinations as to public considerations and a balancing test of what role religion should play in the public sphere based on various principles. The anti-discrimination principle is a universal one and a flat one in a way that is currently existing as a way of answering individual cases. But I'd like to hear how you think you can get to this constitutional ideal without a complete overhaul of public opinion.
The problem is not the law and the constitution. For example, the Muslims don't call for a change of the law. They're happy with the law of 1905. The only problem they have with the law of 1905 is the issue of subsidizing the mosques. Because the law said that religious buildings built before the law are the property of the state, which by definition is obliged to pay for the maintenance. But religious building built after 1905 are supposed to be private property of the faith community, of the congregation. And so there is no state money. So the Muslims claim that this is some sort of a discrimination and that the state should help to build mosques, at least until there are enough mosques for the population. But the authorities, after having been very reluctant, you know, are now far more open. And at the local level, there are ways to find money. And it's the only problem. So the problem is the pressure of the public opinion. Yeah. The attitude of the media also. The public opinion, strangely enough, is very anti-religious in France. Sarkozy, for instance, who is himself, he's not a religious guy, by the way, at all. But on the issue of religion, he's the most open politician we have in France. And he had to tune down, you know, his proposals to be more open as far as the place of religion is concerned in the public sphere. So the issue is an issue of public opinion, not of legal system. The legal system, for the Muslim, it's okay. They have no... what they accuse the government of double standards, you know, that to use the legal system in a discriminatory way. It's true, by the way, not just for Muslims, but also for what we called in France cults. Cults may be religions, which are... it's a paradox, because officially, a religion doesn't need any recognition from the state in France, because there is an absolute separation. But de facto, there is a recognition. Tax administration. If you are religion, you are tax exempted. So, in fact, this is the way to recognize or not. And the big debate, so Islam is recognized, you know, a mosque is tax exempted. And the big debate is now about Jehovah Witnesses. The courts, the High Court has decided that they should be tax exempted. And there is now lobby the parliament to cancel these tax exemptions and to consider the Jehovah Witnesses as a cult. The issue is the public opinion, clearly. And we have now a strange alliance between the ultra-laicists and the Christian right. So, which is the same in all Europe. You know, the alliance of the Christian rights and of leftist secularists. They have a common enemy, Islam. But not for the same reasons, of course, by definition. And this is this alliance which in many countries now is preventing, you know, any progress. Because they could easily have a majority in the different parliaments. And it's If you look in Germany, in France, in Great Britain, we have often this coalition to oppose, for example, the construction of a mosque somewhere. You have the local Catholics, usually the Catholics, local Catholics, and the local leftists opposing the mosque. But the debate between them is, if there is a European culture, what are the basis of these European cultures? And for the secularist, it's secularism. And of course, for the Christians, it's Christianity. So, and this debate is reflected, you know, in the debate between the Catholic Church the rest of the population. When, for example, the Catholic Church is trying to impose a reference to the Christianity of Europe in the Constitution, in the European Constitution, they lost. So the underlying debate is the West secularist or is the West Christian? What do we oppose to Islam? Christianity or secularism? And it's not clear.
Some more questions? Yeah.
Hello. Sorry, I've missed half of it. But I have two questions. The first one being, first, do you think things are getting better in France today?
Sorry?
Do you think things are getting better in the respect of discrimination towards Muslim and the acceptance of Muslim who reclaim to have a citizenship rights? That's the first thing. And also, don't you think I currently live in France and I'm actually astounded by the way the media represents these world problems? And I think, in a way, the media are a key issue, are a key problem of the issue of discrimination, because I think public opinion could maybe change if the media was less discriminatory towards Muslims. So don't you think that is connected to what we're talking about as well? Thanks.
Things are getting better. there are two levels. One is religious practices. So now there are no more underground mosques. It's finished. You know. Mosques are being built. There are mosques. Why? Because the issue, this is always, are almost always the local authorities. The debate is not because of them, between it. The debate is not between the Muslims and the state. The debate is always at the local level between municipality and local Muslim organizations. Yeah. For years, the mayors were afraid, for good or bad reasons, to see mosques being built in their town. Either they were personally opposed for ideological or political reasons, or they feared that this could fuel the extreme right. But this taboo has almost disappeared in the 90s. And by the way, there is no correlation between construction of mosques and the score of the extreme right, contrary to many mayors did expect before. Secondly, Muslims are citizens, so they vote. They vote. And of course, there is a problem of registration. So the Muslim vote was always, you know, it was not a factor, because most of these youngsters didn't go to the polling station. But suddenly, last elections, they did. They did. After the riots in the suburbs, the word that Sarkozy used, you know, the scums and things like that, there has been a big movement of registration. In my hometown, for instance, registration did jump of 20% in 1 year. 20%. So for a mayor, you know, it's a big number, 20% of new voters. You know. And also, of course, it is also linked with the emergence of a middle class. This emergence of a middle class is totally ignored by the politicians, by the media, by everybody. But it's a fact. If you go to the local secondary schools, well, now 10 to 20% of the teachers have a Muslim name. If you go to the local hospital, a third of the surgeons and specialists have a Muslim name. So I did some research in my town for the shift in names, because we have no ethnic statistics. But if you just look at names, you know, it works. If you work on a small small space, you know, so a small town, midtown is a good place to work on that. So it's obvious. No? If you look at the center of the town, which is supposedly the fashionable place of the town, you look at who is buying what houses. There is the big avenue where you have the best houses. Yeah. And you look at the names of the proprietors in 100 years. It's very easy. You go to the registers and look. Yeah. So 100 years ago, all only French names. Mm. In the 50s, Dr. Napolitano bought the best house. And now the house of the Dr. Napolitano has been bought by Dr. Tilam, Hafid Tilam, you know, who is the surgeon at the hospital. So these changes have an impact on elections, on the perception of Muslims, and things like that. But this impact is not reflected by the media. 1 month ago, a team of the Financial Times came to my town to make an inquiry. So I brought them, you know, to the hospital, to the surgeons, to so. But the paper they wrote was about the destitute neighborhoods. Only. Nothing about what is going on outside these neighborhoods. Nothing. So a bleak picture, everything is going worse and worse. Of course, in this destitute neighborhood, things are going worse and worse. Because this phenomena of social promotion have a classical negative impact. You know. The people who succeed leave the destitute neighborhood. So the people who remain in this neighborhood are the losers, by definition. And the phenomenon of ghettoization is increasing in these places, but precisely because there is now this social promotion. And the big issue now in France are the political parties. These guys, the second generation Muslims, they massively joined the Socialist Party. But at every election, the party refused, almost everywhere, to put them in elective position, in a position where they could be elected as mayor, as a member of parliament. And there is a struggle, you know, inside the Socialist Party against among between the older generations, the guys in the 50s, who are mostly French, or the over immigrations, Spanish, Italian names, and so, and the new generation. The new generation are far more opportunist, if I can say that, in political terms, you know. And what does it mean to be a socialist, a rightist? Now all this has been blundered. So what do? They go to the right. And they go to Sarkozy. And we have Rachida Dati. The first time that a Muslim, quote-unquote, minister is not in charge of other Muslims. It's a real promotion. So the gentrification, if I can say that, of the middle class is playing for the right now. And you go to Germany, go to Holland, the same phenomenon.
And Joe, you just need to use the microphone. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joe Glucksberg from here at OSI. And I've just been kind of thinking through your talk and kind of sketching out something as I've been going along, and I kind of wanted to run it by you and see what you thought and if you could make some comments. I was thinking about the fact that laïcité, by separating out religion, or in a sense, it reifies religion, right? It concretizes religion, makes it something that it might not otherwise have been if that process wasn't in place. And an assimilationist policy based on religion and culture being intertwined, that what you're talking about, which I think is an incorrect assumption, of course, making those two things connected, by reifying religion, if it's connected to culture, then reifies culture as well, and stops an organic process, I think, that historians of religion have said always goes on. Weberian analysis is probably one of the better ones, I think. And the idea that there's a charismatic founder of religion, and as the religion spreads across the globe, it becomes syncretic, picks up things from the different societies. And I was wondering if you feel that in France, what may have occurred is that France was secularizing at the same time that laïcité was imposed. And I was thinking, this all made me think of Turkey, in the sense that in France, you had secularization occurring as a societal phenomenon, where it was happening naturally. Religion was put aside, but it wasn't actually a government policy. Then it became a government policy. But in Turkey, this is what I was hoping you could comment on. In Turkey, you didn't have secularization, and then suddenly you had laïcité forced from above. And maybe I was curious about if the French and European experience could actually tell us a lot about the Turkish experience because of that.
In terms of religion, you are right. This process of reification did occur. You know, for instance, the French Catholic Church was Gallican in the 18th century. It was not opposed, but you know, it wanted to be autonomous towards the Vatican and the Pope. But due to the process of expulsion of the Catholic Church from the political scene in the 19th century, the French Catholic Church became ultramontane, you know, became a staunch supporter of the papal primacy. So clearly, that. and it's why, by the way, many people who were politically laïc were opposed to the law of separation because they thought religion was too important for the state to be let autonomous. That should be some control. And this process of reification, if it happens, which is I'm not sure at all, it could happen through the endeavor of the government to create religious institutions. The governments want to have a Muslim church, you know, with an organization, a pyramidal organization, and things like that. You know. They want the government want to have strong unions because they want to have interlocutors, people who can deliver the goods, you know. It's why they put a lot of support for some people to present them as the head of the Muslim community. Another dimension of reification could be theology. Something which is very interesting is that all our Christian and or secularist states are very concerned about Muslim theology. They want to have imams trained with a good Islam. A good Islam. No, that's a big word, a good Islam. Not good Muslims, but good Islam. And what is good Islam? It's liberal, feminist Islam, and gay-friendly, if possible. Why not? You know, we may find some. But if we look at the Catholic Church, at the evangelicalists, at Orthodox Jews, you know, they are not specifically feminist, gay-friendly, and liberal. So it means that we can deal with decent, conservative, religious people, that laïcité should prevent us to deal with theology. But it's very interesting to see that the debate now is what does the Quran say? Do you really think that a Muslim could be this and that, democratic, secular, and this and that? So what I call the theological prejudice, you know, is now blocking, interfering in the debate. And paradoxically, the fact that our authorities put theology as a not a priority, you know, but as a condition, you know, for Western Islam, may entail some sort of reification, an endeavor, for example, to have an official faculty of Islamic theology, Al-Azhar, and so. Exactly what the Turkish government did. Because in Turkey, you don't have separation of church and state. The Department of Religious Affairs is directly subordinated to the Prime Minister. And it's this Directorate of Religious Affairs which is printing the sermons for the preachers, giving instructions to the imams, and things like that. So in Turkey, this process of reification of an official Islam did occur. And then, by reaction, it created, you know, other entities, the Alevi, for example, in Turkey. Who are they? You know, if there is an official Islam, then the people who don't fit with this official Islam, they have to define themselves. So either they go for another religion, or for an other school of thought in this religion, or for an ethnic identity, or for a political identity, and so on and so. There is a danger of reification of religion through the endeavors of institutional integration of religion, clearly.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Just two matters. One, listening to your optimism about the integration of the Muslim community in France, reminds me, perhaps mistakenly, of the history of the Jews of Germany, who also became extremely well integrated and extremely successful, and then public opinion bit back very hard, as we know. What you haven't commented on very much is language, especially if there is a difference between the situation in Germany, for example, and in France, where there's great resentment of the lack of competent German-speaking people, and in England, where there doesn't seem to be much of a problem at all, and yet a great deal of militants. And so is language a factor at all?
No, language is no more a factor. No. The second generation everywhere are now more fluent in, totally fluent in the Western language, and less fluent in the languages of origin. There are big discrepancies, of course. The most linguistically integrated are the French, for very good reasons. Their native language is not a language, you can say that. It's a dialect, you know. North Africans, either they speak Moroccan, Algerian, or Tunisian dialect, or they speak a Berber language. So they don't understand classical Arabic. And now there is a problem. What do if we want to teach them the so-called language of origin, which language? A dialect? Quranic Arabic? Or the Arabic of Al Jazeera? So it's done. In Great Britain, too. Germany, it's a bit different because Turkish remains as a language for different reasons. First, Turkish is, in a sense, a European language. It's written in Latin alphabet. The level of alphabetization in Turkey is the same than in Europe, the same level of literacy. The Turkish government is have a policy, you know, of sending teachers, and even imams, by the way, sending teachers to the West. There are very good networks of Turkish TV channels. So it's also, if you go to my hometown, you go to the bookshop, you have one newspaper in Arabic, just two copies every day, no more. You have three North African newspapers in French, but two, three copies. And you have dozens of Hürriyet, Zaman, dozens of Turkish newspapers in Turkish, while the Turkish population is less numerous than the Arab population. So Turkish remains strong, but if you go to Germany, third generation level, German is dominant among the youth. They speak in German between themselves, no more in Turkish. No, a big change. Your comparison with the Jews in Germany, I don't buy it, except maybe in Germany. but elsewhere, no. Individual integration does work. Intermarriages are very numerous. And in France, racism is more complex, you know, because we have a long tradition of immigration and intermarriages. Yes. This play a role when you have suddenly a competition, as I said, between newcomers and established, you know. The left, as I said, had a pro-migrant policy, but an anti-Muslim policy. The left is far more open as far as immigration is concerned, visa, familial rapprochement, and things like that, far more open. But if we look inside the parties, the left is more closed, you know, to the social ascension, political ascension of Muslims. In the hospitals, when there is a debate on who will replace the head of the surgical service, then if one of the candidates is a Muslim, racism might play a role because there is a competition for power. So, of course, racism does exist and will not stop like that. But it occurs also, it accompanies also this process of... and I would say there is no this the feeling among Muslims to belong to a community. We never use the term Muslim community. There is no community. There is a population.
I think we're just about out of time. I'm not sure that how well or how completely the Gallic suspicious laïcité will map in a long term to Anglo-Saxon indulgence. But that will be tested, I suppose, in places like Great Britain, where it's, I guess, currently under considerable pressure. We have to leave it for the a kind of a Tocquevillian voyage for you in the future to explore what would happen in the United States if laïcité were to become part of the discourse here. I somehow foresee great difficulties, even greater than in Europe. I want to, before saying goodbye, I want to remind people about Beurre is Beautiful and the film festival, the Cinema East Film Festival. For OSI employees, we have a number of complimentary tickets. The others of you will have to pay. it's always thought-provoking and a pleasure to have you here, Olivier, and we'll see you on your next visit. So thank you.
Thank you.